This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an epidemiologist who sees the U.S. continuing a cycle of reduced resources for public health now that the COVID-19 pandemic has receded from public attention. Now, more and more people in the U.S. are reporting being diagnosed with depression. Recent polling from Gallup found that nearly 3 out of 10 people say they have been told by a doctor or nurse that they have depression at some point in their lives. That number has risen steadily from 2015, when the rate was only 2 out of 10. And the percentage of people who report currently having a depression diagnosis is up about 7% over that same time span. The CDC released a new report earlier this month that confirmed similar nationwide numbers as of 2020, and that CDC data showed Wisconsin ranked 23rd in the nation in rates of depression, right around 20%. We're exploring some of the possible causes and solutions to depression, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think might be causing this increase in the rate of diagnosis of depression? Are there solutions you think could start reverse this trend? If you've experienced depression yourself or in your family and are willing to share your story, love to hear from you. Was there a treatment that you found that worked? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jack Nitschke is a clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello, happy to be here.
Can you give us sort of the basic definition of depression from a clinical standpoint?
Yeah, so depression can occur in a number of different forms. The most common form is something that we technically talk about as major depressive disorder. And it is essentially a set of 9 different symptoms, one of which is depressed mood. Another of the common ones is not the inability to experience pleasure or not having interest in things that we usually are interested in. And then there's a set of other symptoms that include different things, including disturbances to sleep, either insomnia or sleeping too much, called hypersomnia, disturbances with eating, having no appetite at all, or some people are depressed are suddenly eating a whole lot, as well as just symptoms like fatigue and feeling worthless, having trouble making up one's mind about something. So as you can see, depression involves, a number of different symptoms here. And any individual might have, some subset of those. But typically how we go about defining depression is that you have to have 5 out of these 9 symptoms.
Looking at these numbers with higher rates of depression diagnosis, that sounds bad, certainly. A lot of us are depressed, and that's bad news. But it could also be that maybe we're paying more attention, we're seeking out treatment, we're doing a better job of screening for it. Do you have a sense of what might be driving that numbers? More depression, or we're more alert to depression?
So there are many factors that contribute to the cause of depression. And the question here with these latest data that have just come out is, what is leading to this increase currently? I don't think there's been a real stark increase in recent, just in the last couple of years in terms of just the increased awareness of it. Now, that may have been happened a little bit with the pandemic. It certainly happened a lot over the last 30 years. For a long period of time, we were not seeing increased numbers in depression, but we also weren't seeing decreased numbers in depression, despite the fact that we have now much better treatments for it. So this has been, an issue for us in the field of wanting to, have rates of depression decrease from what they are. So, but your question as to why are they increasing now, again, there could be several factors. I think one of the things we have to look at is the pandemic, which, thankfully we're on the backside of. But, during the pandemic, that certainly isolated folks. We know that social support is really good at helping keep depression at bay. But also the pandemic interrupted people's work and led to inflation by interrupting the supply chain. This led to financial stress. We know that financial stress is going to feed anxiety and depression. And so that too could in part be leading to higher rates of depression.
And you mentioned treatments for depression, and I want to definitely talk about that. What are the main kinds of treatment out there that seem to be proving effective, at least for some people experiencing depression?
Yeah, there's two basic classes of treatment that are kind of the front line of treatment. One is in the field of psychotherapy, and we have different treatments such as cognitive behavioral therapy, another type of treatment known as interpersonal therapy for depression, another treatment that's called ACT. And so there's a number of treatments that have been developed over the years that are very good and empirically are we have evidence that really do help people get over their depressive episodes. On the flip side, for those who don't want to do some of the work that's involved with psychotherapy, there's also the possibility of taking medications. We have antidepressants that are very good for treating depression in a lot of individuals. And these are some, really some household names now, such as Prozac and Zoloft, as well as a host of others that have very similar chemical properties to those two. And that target specific neurotransmitter systems in the brain. And those two have been found to be helpful with depression.
We're talking about depression, rising rates of depression diagnosis here in the United States, and treatments with Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Jack, a lot of your research, I know, involves the idea of neuroplasticity. And this is a key part of understanding how some of those treatments you talked about work. First of all, what do we mean by neuroplasticity?
So neuroplasticity is a set of brain mechanisms that are involved in helping us adapt to change and leading us to be able to do things such as learn. And so basically the idea here is that whatever it is that you're going to spend your time doing, particularly those things that you repeat over and over again, you will build neural connections that support that behavior or that thought or that feeling. And such that, if, for example, in depression, something that's common is that you have self-critical thoughts. And if you think I'm no good, and we have maybe somebody that's told us we're not good enough when we're young children, and then we practice, and then we kind of hear that multiple times, and then we actually internalize that and walk around such that we're saying, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough. Each time that gets that repetition, it is strengthening those neural circuits that support that in our brain. And so then part of what we're doing with psychotherapy is actually going in and testing, is that true? Am I really not good at something? And for all of my patients, I find the good aspects of who they are. We talk about that and the evidence for that. And then what we're doing is slowly building neural connections that support the knowledge that they are indeed good people as they walk through their life.
And that plasticity idea, I could see somebody, especially in the midst of depression, saying all those things are carved in stone, the bad self-talk and things like that. But we can, if I'm hearing you right, Jack, have a new process of learning that gets a new set of connections, literally neural connections in our brain that provides an alternative?
Yeah, it's exactly right. You've talked about a little bit the bad news about neuroplasticity here. The bad news about neuroplasticity, if we do have these self-critical thoughts, is once that's been practiced along a lot, that's around essentially for the rest of our lives. Things that we have done a lot of repetition for, we are going to have neural connections that support that for the rest of our life. We can't go in and surgically remove that. So that's kind of the bad news. The good news, however, is that we can go and use those exact same neuroplasticity mechanisms to learn new truths about who we are and how we are able to handle situations. And then we can practice those, repeat that, such that we are building new neural circuits that more accurately reflect who we are, and that can help us to feel better.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi.
Hello, sir.
What did you want to share with us, Mike?
I felt like my dad and I connected better altogether, and he's passed away, but my mom and I never saw things the same way. I'm just wondering, I got divorced 3 years ago, and I need some help.
Mike, I'm so sorry to hear all of that, and best to you. Now, Jack, obviously I won't ask you to diagnose and prescribe options for Mike, but for somebody in that position, very dark position in his life right now, what can people do to start seeking help?
Yeah, so what Mike is referring to or is indicating that he's struggling with is grief. And grief is a very close relative of depression, and it's associated with sadness. There's also other elements that can be present, other components of grief, including there can be feelings of anger there. There can be feeling times where one's in denial about having lost somebody, as well as there are periods of time maybe that Mike has where he is very much accepting that his father is not here, yet still has a great deal of sadness. We know with grief that grief is actually something that stays with us when you have somebody as close to us as it sounds like Mike was with his father, that grief will probably stay with Mike for much of his life, but it will take on different forms, such that when Mike is, you know, if is able to process some of this grief, talk through both the wonderful things about his dad and the connection that they had, as well as just acknowledging, you know, the sadness not only of losing his father, but also the end of that marriage. And to process that and work with that. And essentially, he's going to be to speak with the, you know, speak to what I just spoke about with the neural connections. He's going to be building up some neural connections for how do you kind of walk through life without dad physically present here.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Best to you as you deal with all of that. And Jack, I wonder about, in addition to maybe one-on-one therapy, what do you think about support groups? Because obviously the people Mike would want to talk to things about in tough times, well, that's not an option now. Are there things like grief support groups or divorce support groups that people can at least get some of that from?
Absolutely. There are good grief support groups out there that will tell you a little bit about the different stages or components of grief, as well as just to have you be in a setting where you can be with other people who are also really struggling with the loss of somebody that they have loved very dearly, as it's really clear is the case for Mike.
We're talking to clinical psychologist and UW-Madison professor Jack Nitschke about depression and an increasing rate of patients receiving a diagnosis of depression over the last handful of years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we could start to reduce rates of depression in our society, big picture and individually too? What questions do you have about the way we diagnose and treat depression? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison, looking at a growing number of people diagnosed with depression in the United States, what treatment and possible solutions are out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it would take to improve mental health in our country? Do you have a question for our guest about diagnosis, treatment, the causes of depression? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Hey, here's another number if you need it or a loved one needs it, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's a call or a text to 988. Again, that's 988. Jack, I want to talk a little more about the causes of depression. Sometimes we think of it as, you know, a traumatic maybe life event causing it. Sometimes we hear, at least in the past, I've heard about, you know, this is a brain chemistry thing. Are they both out there? Is it some of each? What do we think about the causes now?
Yeah, there are many factors that are causal in nature, you know, and one of the issues that I like to be really careful about being a neuroscientist myself is to move away from some thinking about, oh, this is just, you know, something that happens in the brain. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the brain is going to be involved in it. This is, you know, the organ that helps us have feelings and emotions. It mediates that process. But it's also really, really key that there are other components that contribute to that as well. And these components are things that are happening in our environment. They may be some things from childhood. They could be trauma that can lead to profound feelings of depression and trauma of all different sorts. And they can also be things that happen to us later in life, difficulties with with employment or losing a friend. And then importantly, as we just heard about, is, you know, the end of a marriage potentially can be a cause for depression, as well as sometimes losing somebody goes beyond just the grief, but can be a more protracted period of depression that some people experience after losing a loved one. So exact nature of what the cause of depression is really multifactorial.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Sauk City. Jackie, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jackie?
I just wanted to say I'm a community psychiatric nurse, and so I was listening to the program and was very interested in what Mike had to say. And I just feel like your speaker didn't necessarily point him into a direction that could be helpful, and I would encourage Mike to seek help from his primary care doctor, who could possibly assess him for suicidality, and then get him started on an antidepressant if the doctor felt that was necessary, and then refer him to outpatient psychiatric treatment somewhere.
Jackie, thanks for that call. And Jack, I've heard and I've talked to guests about making sure that more primary care physicians are doing these kind of screenings for depression and other mental health needs, making the kind of referrals Jackie is talking about. Do you feel like we're getting better at doing those things?
I don't know what Jackie thinks about it. I think we are getting better at doing those. And Jackie's certainly right on spot on in terms of the recommendations she's making there. Our primary care physicians are oftentimes very good at helping to manage. And indeed, a number of people will just be on an antidepressant medication that their primary care physician is managing. So, and then and then a lot of times, as Jackie just alluded to, it can be very helpful for the primary care physician to say, oh, this is looking a little bit more complex, might be a benefit to have some psychotherapy, and if the depression gets really bad over a period of time, there's also some other forms of treatment that can be utilized that have been shown to be helpful, and to make that referral to mental health, behavioral health services.
Jackie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jack, do we have enough services available for people who are seeking help, who do need help, or is it hit or miss depending on where we are?
In terms of psychiatric services, I would say we do not have enough. I'm part of a big department here in Madison, so associated with the University of Wisconsin, our Department of Psychiatry, and it has been something that we have really worked very hard to meet and provide access to all the people in the community who are asking for services. It's become even a greater need since the pandemic. We've increased the numbers of our providers multiple fold, and we still are not able to meet all the need in the community. This is a place where indeed, though, primary care physicians do help out. So when somebody has a form of depression that is more manageable, that can be overseen by a primary care physician doc. And that is happening, increasingly.
I want to get back to the idea of neuroplasticity. Another thing you work on is human brain imaging. I mean, are we at a point where we could image our brain and see ourselves making these connections to counter the paths we've built up in the past when it comes to things like depression?
No, we're not at that point, and I don't know that we will necessarily get to that point with brain imaging. The brain imaging is not at nearly as molecular of a level as that, so it's looking at more different areas of the brain, how different areas are involved when it's done with depression and anxiety, how different areas of the brain are involved differentially on different types of tasks. One thing that's become really clear from the last 30 years of the huge amount of brain imaging work that's now been done, is that there is no center in the brain that is the source of depression or the source, the source of depression here. And that it's a much more complicated picture than that. And I think one of the, you know, the some of this work that's been done with neuroplasticity and an understanding that that can really help understand what is going on in a person's brain as this depression is developing, as well as when they're getting effective treatment.
And we've been focusing on individual diagnosis and treatment a lot here, Jack. Getting back to, you know, this overall increase in depression, you mentioned earlier, you know, isolation from COVID, disruption from COVID might have been a cause of that increase. Does that point us towards some society-wide solutions? Are there things we could do as a country that might build those connections, do things that help prevent people being depressed in the first place?
Yeah, I think there certainly are with some of that. I mean, so one is just policies that we are going to have. So I think, you know, in terms of, having, making sure that employment and income is being supported so that people can, meet the cost of living, making sure that we're keeping an eye on inflation and keeping the cost of living down that way. So I think there's policy work that can be done there. And then I think there's things we can do in the community really to encourage the social support that people can have access to, encourage kind of community involvement so that people can turn to people when they are feeling, when they are struggling. One of the things that you've mentioned here is the 988 number. That's just a crisis line. It's also a suicide hotline. That's, you know, another good tool that's just come online, the 988 specifically. There was a much longer 800 number that was used for many years prior to that. But this 988 number just allows for more accessibility for people to get the help and the support they need.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about why we're seeing more and more of it in the U.S., what we can do about it. And again, that number 988 for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. You can call or text 988. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, forensic science looks really impressive in police procedural shows on TV, but reality doesn't always match up with the fiction. Find out more in a new book from The Innocence Project. Check it out. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8. You can listen online at WPR.org or live here on the Ideas Network. I pretty much always have a song stuck in my head. Sometimes it's something I like, so that's okay. Sometimes it's something I don't like, and I try to get it out of there. And sometimes it's something really random, like my current song.
Muncha, buncha, muncha, buncha, muncha, buncha, muncha, buncha, Fritos go with lunch. Muncha, buncha, muncha, buncha, muncha, buncha, muncha,
yes.
Buncha, Fritos.
Last night, a junk food TV commercial from my childhood popped into my head. Why? Well, I was grocery shopping, but I didn't even go to the aisle with all the chips. I haven't munched that particular product for at least a couple of few years. I found the commercial online this morning. There's a kid in the commercial who looked a lot like me as a kid. Even had a shirt kind of like his. I was never in a Fritos commercial or any commercial. Anyhow, I eagerly await the next selection in my brain's playlist to knock the commercial jingle out of the way. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. saw increased attention to public health efforts at the beginning of COVID and less attention now. An epidemiologist says that's a common cycle of panic and then neglect that ends up leaving us less prepared for the next disease outbreak. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a unique summer job.
Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night can stop postal carriers from delivering the mail, as the unofficial motto goes. But for some teenage mail carriers in southern Wisconsin, there are even more hurdles to surmount. As WPR's Sarah Lear tells us, the Lake Geneva mail jumpers hop from ship to shore as they deliver letters to lakefront homes.
One of the typical uniforms for U.S. Postal Service mail carriers includes a blue-collared shirt and an over-the-shoulder satchel. But for some mail routes in Lake Geneva, one of Wisconsin's trendy resort cities, a life jacket is part of the necessary apparel. More than a dozen teens lined up on the deck of a cruise ship on a recent rainy morning. They're competing for an unusual summer job, delivering mail by boat on Geneva Lake. During its delivery runs, the mail ship never stops. Jumpers have to leap from deck to pier and back again as they drop off mail and collect outgoing letters. Captain Ray Ames briefs the hopefuls.
Remember, you're going from a moving boat onto a stationary pier. You lead with your right going off. Don't try to plant your feet and stop. Run it out.
18-year-old Erin Hensler grew up near Lake Geneva, where mailboat jumpers are idolized. She hopes to secure a spot for her second summer of jumping.
There's a lot of adrenaline, and, you know, some people chase the runners high. We chase the jumpers high.
Mail's been delivered by boat in the southeast Wisconsin vacation town since the late 1800s, when many newly built estates were hard to reach by road. Now carriers can drive mail trucks to those houses, but some lakefront homeowners still like to keep the tradition alive. Close to 80 of them choose to have their letters and newspapers dropped off by mailboat jumpers every summer. It's part of a long-standing agreement between the cruise line and the local post office. Harold Freestead became part of that legacy when he started driving the mailboat in the 1960s. The 83-year-old has since retired after decades managing the cruise line, but he still returns to the lake to witness tryouts.
Such a positive experience to be able to jump right off on these private piers and this elegance all around you and all the people on the boat that love every second of it.
Try and make sure.
Right, grab with both hands.
The job is coveted, and it requires firm footing. Run too fast before you jump back on the boat and you risk a collision. That's how a few past jumpers have cracked the ship's glass windows. Hesitate, and you'll plunge straight into Geneva Lake, like 16-year-old Emma Bond during tryouts.
She in? She went in.
The boat kept chugging along at about 10 miles per hour.
And I tried to pull myself back, but the momentum of the boat, or trying to get to the boat, just pulled me in. My mom packed extra clothes just in case. I think she jinxed me.
Trying to stay dry is just part of the job. The boat jumpers also give tours to the passengers who ride along during each mail run.
All the next six properties are especially interesting as they are currently, or were at one point, all part of the Rigby estate.
That's 19-year-old Marissa Torres-Raby, one of the more experienced jumpers, talking about the history of the mansions that were built along the lake by Chicago business titans. During tryouts, the boat jumpers are graded on their narration, and former male jumper Katie Tice is one of the judges. She's looking for jumpers with stage presence.
So we're looking at people skills and athleticism and how comfortable they are with all that put together.
Not every part of the job is glamorous. Jumpers start sorting mail by 7 a.m., and they have to clean the ship's bathrooms. But mailboat jumpers say there's no other way they'd rather spend their summers.
WPR's Sarah Lear brought us that story on the Lake Geneva mail jumpers. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. The federal COVID emergency officially ended last month, and as part of the negotiations between House Republicans and President Joe Biden to raise the national debt limit, they agreed to force a return of $27 billion in funding to federal agencies that had been set aside for fighting the pandemic. According to reporting from NPR, this clawback included a significant amount from the Public Health and Social Services Emergency Fund for Emergency Preparedness and Response. Our next guest says we are in a predictable cycle of panic and neglect that leaves us unprepared for the next public health emergency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How prepared do you feel the U.S. is for future public health emergencies? Do you see lessons learned or lessons ignored from COVID? What questions do you have for our guest epidemiologist about how the public health system works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Caitlin Jedalina is the founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist and director of population health analytics at Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. She recently wrote about this in that newsletter. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Now, first of all, this take back of funds at the end of the public health emergency, you describe it, quote, there being chaos rippling throughout public health under the surface. What was the immediate impact of pulling this money back out of public health funding?
Yeah, we didn't really know what the immediate impact was until it started unfolding and the implementation was sent down the federal lines. And I think that this rippling effect is just not apparent to the average person because, of course, we're in a different phase of the pandemic, one that seems much more manageable with COVID-19. Why would we possibly need funding for an emergency? Well, this chaos is an incredible reality to us on the ground, and it's the clearest sign yet that the U.S. is really resorting to its roots in public health of, like you said, cycles of panic and neglect.
And that's the core of your piece. We get really interested in public health and argue about it when there's a public health crisis going on, and then out of sight, out of mind once it ends. Can you talk about how that pattern has come and gone and what it means for our preparedness?
Yeah, you know, this cycle of panic and neglect isn't new. In fact, it even has a name. The Sisyphean cycle was coined after Greek mythology about a trickster who received basically internal punishment for trying to cheat death and was condemned by the gods to roll a boulder up a steep hill for eternity. And every time he reached that top of the hill, the rock rolled back to the bottom, forcing him to start over again. And this hamster wheel effect is all too familiar in public health. COVID-19 wasn't the first boulder we've pushed up a hill. For example, in 2003, with the SARS epidemic, we pushed a SARS vaccine as quickly up a hill as possible. But then SARS was thankfully contained, research money dried up. No vaccine was made and the boulder fell down the hill again. I think what people need to recognize is if that boulder didn't fall down, we would have had a COVID-19 vaccine for the pandemic far quicker, 17 years later, than we did. I think there was a lot of hope among the public health atmosphere that a pandemic would change this model, right? Surely losing 1 million people could change something. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like that. And after giving our all, we're actively watching this boulder roll down the hill again.
When it comes to our public health infrastructure, you know, we've got federal public health agencies and state and lots of local, county, municipal, tribal, et cetera, et cetera. Did we learn any lessons about how to coordinate among all those levels better? Or is that another case of, you know, we started there, got there, and then let the boulder roll back down the hill?
Gosh, we learned a lot. We learned a lot about the need of coordination. You know, local health departments and state health departments do an amazing job on smaller outbreaks before the pandemic, but COVID-19 was just a completely different beast. And it showed our underfunded, fragmented public health infrastructure and really shed light on it. And like you said, the need for coordination. Right now, there's a massive move forward for data modernization so we can have data talk across state lines and to CDC more clearly. But even that coordination isn't being implemented on the ground. And a lot of people are fearful that we haven't or we're not implementing those lessons learned. And so I think that as professionals, we've certainly learned a lot, but again, implementation, what actually changes is unfortunately due to congressional funding and us figuring out a way to end this perpetual cycle of panic and neglect.
Now, you mentioned that previous SARS outbreak, and you point toward one country that you think did learn lessons, and that's Vietnam. Can you talk about how they handled that one, what they tried to learn from it that you say helped deal with COVID now?
Yeah, Vietnam's a really interesting story, and I've loved learning about them and watching them throughout the pandemic. You know, they have one of the lowest cumulative COVID deaths in the world, And this isn't because they just had a magic eight ball. You know, one reason is that they learned from their previous mistakes. They had an imperfect response to SARS. And instead of just going back to business as normal after SARS, they changed their entire system, public health system, through adequate funding, through implementation of a national public health response system, through core communications, through emergency capabilities. And it really paid off during the pandemic. And one thing I've been really hopeful for is us learning what worked and what didn't work and why during COVID, because this was really one of the first pandemic emergencies the United States has really had to face. And it would be a tragedy if we did not learn from those lessons.
We're talking to Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist. We're talking about the way the United States responds to, then moves on from, public health emergencies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You have questions for our guest. Do you think we've learned any lessons, or are we as unprepared as we might have been before COVID? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in public health out there, love to hear your perspective on this. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about cycles of panic and neglect in public health. Our guest is Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What lessons, if any, do you hope we learned from our public health response to COVID-19? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Joe is with us in Star Lake. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. This is, might seem a very small thing, but I think it's a lot bigger than people realize. And when your guest was talking about core communication in a pandemic situation, this could be very important. We're a very visual society anymore. Most people are getting their information from television. And all through the pandemic, every time any news show covered the pandemic, even if it was a very positive thing about getting vaccinated, all they showed was images of people getting shots. My wife and I would just watch this over and over and over and think of Marshall McLuhan. It's just, it was totally the wrong message. It just made people anxious. And they, you never watch a drug company, will never do that. You know, they'll talk about their drug, but they won't see somebody getting shot with it. It was just the worst possible thing we could have done. And so we saw such an anti-vaccine attitude grow up. And I think this really played a role in it. And I think we should address that well in advance of the next time.
Interesting.
In fact.
Joe, yeah. Thanks for the call. Caitlin, the way we communicated messages to the public, we being the public health community, we in the media, the government, are there lessons you hope we learned as Joe hopes we do?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I completely agree with Joe, and I could sit here for hours talking about it. But quickly, I completely agree. We completely botched the scientific communication and knowledge translation throughout the pandemic, both reactive, right? So combating mis and disinformation, but I think even more so proactive communication. We're not good at risk communication. We're not good at talking about uncertainty and taking people along for the scientific discovery ride. We didn't have massive health campaigns around vaccines. And so people, rightfully so, had a ton of questions and nowhere to really find evidence-based information to make decisions off of. And this is a huge problem, and we need to fix it so we get trusted, relevant, understood, and then used information out in a timely manner when people need to make decisions. And this is something I fear that we also haven't learned throughout the pandemic. And I've been disappointed in the little movement towards that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joe, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Caitlin Jedalina. You can follow her work and read the piece we're talking about on the newsletter online called Your Local Epidemiologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Nancy is with us in Minocqua. Nancy, hi.
Yes, I'm kind of just upset and tired of our healthcare in this country and the pandemic and all that being a bipartisan. It's like each side has to do something to take something away from the other side. Democrats have to get it, then Republicans want to take it away, and it should just be something that we work together for to have health care in this country.
Nancy, thanks for that call. That's interesting, Caitlin, because when we look back at past pandemics, it seems kind of predictable that there's going to be some kind of political divide. And we read stuff about the 1917 flu outbreak and arguments over mask requirements, the first smallpox inoculations, not even vaccines yet in the 1700s, George Washington requiring troops to get inoculated. Is this something that epidemiologists like look at and try to figure out how to contend with, given that it seems to happen in most outbreaks?
It does happen in most outbreaks. In fact, public health is inherently political. We get our funding from Congress. We have to, you know, outbreak and emergency decisions aren't just based on science, but it's also based on cultural and moral and psychological views of communities. And it requires bi-directional relationship with communities. And so I'm just as exhausted as Nancy about the bipartisanship and this fight against each other. I think one thing we could have done and should have done much better, and in fact, Vietnam did this, was we needed to set the stage of SARS-CoV-2 much earlier and really frame it as it's us against a common enemy, the virus, rather than us against each other.
Thanks a lot.
That messaging framing would have helped a little, but it's going to get political, and epidemiologists are not trained in that, and I think that we need to be. And particularly, I'm very excited for the new director at the CDC, Mandy Cohen, because she gets politics and she gets operations, and I think it'll be very interesting to see what she can do with that.
Thanks for that call, Nancy. Daryl is with us now in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Yeah, I think that the health organization did everything they possibly could to make the public aware of what they thought would help with COVID. And we didn't have any experience with this in the past. This is all new to everybody. And also, we had a president in office who did everything he could to fight against all the good advice that was put out there to get vaccinated, to get COVID shots and everything, and he laughed at it and made it, oh, it's not a big deal, it's just going to go away on its own. So we didn't even have a president that could lead and show the public the right direction to go to, and that really played a huge part against not being successful with having COVID handled properly.
Gotcha. Daryl, thanks a lot for that call. Kaylee, why don't we focus in on Daryl's first point there, that this is a disease that we hadn't encountered exactly before. It was something different. And that's, in some ways, always going to be the case in a pandemic. How we react to one disease might look different from another. Could you talk about that scramble to get a grip on a disease that may not look like the last pandemic?
It is a scramble. And I think that's a great way to explain it. And I think the best way to bring the public along is to communicate consistently about what we do know, but more importantly, what we don't know and how we're trying to find those answers. Because the information is going to change, and it was changing incredibly rapidly. And we weren't bringing people along for that scientific discovery ride, which made it really challenging for people to pivot when we found out new information and new ways to protect ourselves. And that's something we can do better in other crises, right? It's crisis communication 101. Be first, be right, be credible, and be empathetic. And I would argue that we failed on a lot of those fronts.
I want to take a minute or two to talk about where we are with COVID right now, Caitlin. The public health emergency is over, but it's not gone. COVID, as I'm reading, the seventh leading cause of death in the United States in this current year, 2023, over 1,000 deaths a week for the most part. What are you watching for in the current state of COVID, even though it's not, you know, as front and center as it was?
Yeah, we're in a really interesting time right now. In fact, in epidemiology, we don't even have a word for this like transition state between full-blown emergency and predictability. We're really in this transition phase. I think that, you know, all of us are really looking to see how the rest of the year plays out. Like you said, COVID is still around. It's mutating about twice as fast as flu. And I think the big question we have right now is, when is it going to become into more a predictable pattern? Is this the year that it falls into winter respiratory season with RSV and flu, or are we going to see multiple waves still? And no one really knows that answer. And unfortunately, we are at the mercy of time. We're also all holding our breath that we don't see a variant of concern come out of the blue. We actually have a pretty high probability of that happening, about 40% in the next year. And what that means and how hard it will be to have resources and inform people, given that we're not in an emergency mode with tons of federal funding, will be very interesting, to say the least, of how that unfolds. So there's still a lot of unanswered questions. I think a lot of us are enjoying this lull in massive transmission and really getting prepared for the fall and winter.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist. We talked to her about the ups and downs in attention to public health. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out federal broadband expansion money coming to parts of Wisconsin that don't have access to high-speed internet connections. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an argument based on the independent legislature theory that would let state legislatures around the country set election laws without input from state courts, governors, or state constitutions. We'll find out how their decision could affect future elections in Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time.